What do you get when you take a person with a 20-year career as a TV reporter and producer covering true crime cases who decides to write fiction? What you get is a mystery novel written by someone who knows what she is talking about. Hang on and join me and my guest, Wendy Whitman, right after this musical intro.
It's time to put on your sleuthing cap, feel nail-biting dread, and face heart-racing fear. This is Queer Writers of Crime, where you'll get book recommendations and hear interviews with LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Here's your host, Brad Shreve.
Hi, I'm Brad, and welcome to Queer Writers of Crime. My guest today is Wendy Whitman, and she published a mystery novel, and it's a little exciting because she has kind of an education that most of us don't have that's unique. Wendy, what is it? What were you able to do that gave us a different viewpoint of as a mystery writer?
Well, I worked at Core TV and then on the Nancy Grace Show for a combined 20 years, covering pretty much every high-profile murder case in America. So I always felt I had a book in me, and I felt that I was able to bring something to the crime thriller genre that a lot of even talented authors necessarily wouldn't, because I just saw so much of the way the legal system works in so many different murder cases and really has been able to get into the mind of a killer and how they think and function. So I think all of that 20-year history definitely went into my book and really shows in the book.
Yeah, a good perspective that most of us can't get. So I'm sure you've learned a lot over the years.
I have.
Ann Apteker is an author and has been a guest on the show a few times. And she was lucky that she worked for a short time for a private investigator. As you imagine, that's an education. One of the things she's told me is, having been in that work, is she became disillusioned with our justice system. Has your work for the 20 years working with true crime television, do you feel the same?
I think that, you know, if you cover enough cases, obviously you're going to get a lot of outcomes that you don't think are just. And you see what the families are put through. And I always say there's no finality in the legal system because things just get appealed and appealed and appealed and appealed. You know, I think that anyone who deals with the legal system over a period of time, you know, is bound to get disillusioned over certain things. And I always tell people there's no real finality to the legal system because things just, you know, you'll hear even if a verdict comes in that you think is correct, then you find out 2 years later they tossed it out or something went wrong or whatever. So you always feel like it just goes on and on and on till one side gets the result they want, potentially. And I've had certain issues with, which I do touch on in my book, even though it's fiction, I was able to do it through the main character's point of view. Undercover cop cars, body bargaining, their rules of evidence. I have a lot of issues with just the overall legal system, the way it works.
Based on your experience, would you say usually justice is served, or do you think it's not enough?
Well, it obviously isn't enough just in terms of anyone who's murdered or what their families and friends and they go through. Nothing could ever, no matter what kind of punishment you do, no matter what anything, nothing can ever correct that and make them whole again. So overall, there are enough travesties of justice or ordeals that families go through of murder victims. So it's sort of hard, even if it's it's hard to judge the percent of what's right and wrong. But there are enough really outrageous things that happen that it is sort of hard to feel good about it at times.
Yeah, I think one of the positive things about our justice system is there are a lot of checks and balances to ensure the wrong person is not convicted.
Correct.
But I would admit, and I think most of us agree that's a great thing, but do you think that does hamper getting the proper convictions at times and causes more grief on the family?
Yeah, I think that there could be something such as a happy medium. Obviously, nobody wants an innocent person to be convicted of anything. And we used to have a joke at Core TV, if you made it this far, you're guilty at the beginning of a trial, because you have to go through so many hurdles to actually be brought to trial. People mm-hmm. don't realize what small percent of cases actually plea bargaining and all that, the number of cases, how hard it is to actually get in front of a jury and get to a trial and even a murder case. So that's why that we used to have that running joke at the beginning of every trial, because it is a lot to get to that point where you're sitting in that defendant seat. That given, it doesn't mean that everyone is guilty, but in this day and age, we have much better technology and DNA. And unless you're living in an incredibly corrupt, you know, area of the country where people just are, you know, they don't care and they just, you know, whatever. Overall, I mean, statistically, they always say that 90 plus percent, I believe, of defendants that are actually brought to trial are guilty. Mm-hmm. Of course, you only want one innocent person to be convicted, God forbid, or in prison. But I do think that it's pretty rare to get for an innocent person to actually be convicted of a murder case. It can happen, of course, but I think with all the appeals, you'd have to have beyond lousy attorneys not to have it corrected.
Yeah, and I know we hear from people that have been in prison for decades, and then DNA evidence finally proves them innocent. Right. So I'm guessing since that's now readily available, we don't have that many mistakes as we used to.
Exactly. When you hear that someone was in for 25 years, you're going back decades where maybe it wasn't done correctly, or maybe it's an area of the country that's less sophisticated with their police enforcement and technology and all that. In today's day and age, again, unless you're in a very corrupt area or a very really unsophisticated, you know, area of the country or whatever, I do think it's pretty rare for a totally innocent person to get arrested for, especially when you're talking about a murder case. But I'm not saying it can't happen, or I'm not saying it doesn't happen.
Yeah, there's never going to be a 100% perfect system. I wish there was to say that that could happen, but we know there's not.
Right. Like we always say, every profession, it can be medicine, it can be teaching, it can be anything. There's always going to be mistakes. That's just the way it is. And no one wants to see mistakes, especially when it comes to legal things and justice, but nothing's ever going to be perfect.
If you enjoy Queer Writers of Crime, let others know with a review. It helps build an audience and introduce more people to queer crime fiction. Apple and iTunes are where most people search for new shows, but if you don't use either, other apps that allow reviews include Podcast Addict, Overcast, and Spotify. Wherever you listen to podcasts, help spread the word to tune in to Queer Writers of Crime.
Is there a particular case that you worked on where you felt justice was not served, that somebody got off?
Well, we would go to the first OJ trial. We obviously thought that wasn't correct. I think Casey Anthony wasn't correct. Although I was on Nancy Grace's show for Casey Anthony. I was the point person, and a friend of mine from Court TV was manning their jury selection, you know, viewing. And once they picked the jury, we knew she was going to walk, and everyone was shocked by the verdict when it happened. But if you actually watched jury selection, you would understand why it happened. And then there are two cases that I sort of became obsessed with that didn't get the media attention I thought they deserved. And that was the Tennessee case of Shannon Christian and Christopher Newsom, who were carjacked and brutally murdered. And then the Carr Brothers case in Wichita, Kansas. So, and I don't think those cases were so horrific. I don't really think they necessarily got a perfect outcome in court. The cases were all tossed in Tennessee, and they had to do retrials, which put the victims' families through a lot of unnecessary angst. And the Wichita case kept getting appealed. They were originally given the death penalty, and I think it did end up going all the way to the Supreme Court. But the victims' families were just put through hell.
I would love to jump into the OJ trial, but we've heard so much about that one. So I'm not familiar with what was the last name of the person named Casey?
Shannon Christian. Oh, Casey Anthony.
Could you tell us about that one? Because that was the first one that came out of your mind after OJ.
Yeah, she was the woman who was accused of killing her little girl. And it blew up in the media. And we did cover the trial on Nancy's show. I think Casey Anthony was a case that got a lot of attention and blew up in the media, and we covered it on Nancy Grace's show, and I was the point person for it, and she did get acquitted by the jury. Media were the Knoxville, Tennessee carjacking and murders of Shannon Christian and Christopher Newsom, and then the Wichita case, the Carr Brothers, who murdered five people in Wichita, Kansas. And I think those, in my opinion, should have been huge national cases. They were such unbelievably horrific crimes. And just legally, that went on for years. And, you know, you would have expected a lot of attention. I was able to get it as much attention as it did get, which was not sufficient. But pretty much any of the attention it did get, we covered. They were just horrific cases. And they were not covered correctly by the media.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I mean, sometimes things just don't end up on people's radar. Sometimes local reporters will call attention to something. And if it's not, you know, Wichita and Knoxville aren't like New York, say, and Boston, maybe. I don't know if it's, you know, they're just varying reasons why certain cases take off and why certain cases don't take off. But we had trial tracking meetings every week, so we were informed of every important murder case in the country. So everything came to our attention. That wouldn't necessarily mean that it came to everyone else's attention.
I'm sure with Court TV and HLN that you tried to cover every case that was worthy of being reported on. But something I've noticed is we see a lot more missing children reports on television. It seems like white kids than black kids. And I don't think that's my perception. Based on what you've seen, not necessarily with what you did, do you think there's something to what I'm saying?
I always hate discussing race involving murder cases because I don't look at it that way. I look at it, I couldn't care less the race of the victim, the race of the defendant. To me, it's all about the actions and everything. We certainly selected trials based on what we thought were appropriate cases to cover. It never had anything to do with race. I can't speak for the entire media and how people approach covering cases, but I know we were truly race and gender neutral. We covered cases based on specific criteria, what the event was, what happened, who was involved. Certain celebrity cases usually made the cut, but we were very professional and objective in the way we chose cases to cover.
So I have a question for you that has gotten a big deal since it became a part of our legal system. What do you think about harder convictions for those that commit hate crimes?
You mean more strict sentencing?
Yeah. Do you think that's a good thing?
I don't think it's a bad thing. I think going more generally speaking, I think that once you get to murder, everyone should be getting the maximum they can get. So Yes, I'm not objecting to doing hate crime stuff for if you're attacking a specific person because of their sexual orientation or religion or race or anything like that, because you obviously want to dissuade that kind of behavior. But then on the other hand, when I look at a murder case, I think all murder is so bad that everyone should be getting the maximum. You know, like to me, it's nothing to enhance. You should already be getting the maximum. However, as I said, I think the purpose of hate crime laws was to acknowledge, give some kind of publicity and a forum for groups that are attacked just because of who they are. And of course, you want that not to happen. But all murder obviously is horrific, and all murder should be treated to the max as far as I can see.
Yeah, just to toss in my feelings, I certainly think hate crimes need to be reported and tracked. I think it's a part of learning how to resolve the problem.
Right.
But I have really, and boy, I'm going to get some feedback probably from this one. I have real problems with hate crime, the whole issue. Because if I'm walking down the street and somebody beats me to death, right, whether I'm gay or it's because I was wearing a blue shirt or they wanted right. the $1.95 in my pocket, I'm right. dead. I don't really care.
Right.
It's like we're saying hate crimes are bad. Other murders, well, they're not as bad. And that's why I have an issue with it.
That's what I was trying to convey just then, that all murder is so bad that once you talking about hate crimes as murders, you know, relating to murders, there is no elevation. Everyone who commits a murder should be treated accordingly, and it shouldn't, none of that should matter. But I think the mentality behind it was to call attention to minority groups, whether it's gay or this or that, a lot of, you know, anti-Semitic events, things like that. I understand the mentality behind it, but I think, again, I'm sort of agreeing with you. Once you get to murder, you need to be punished to the max, as far as I can see. The other murders aren't lesser because they didn't pick on you for that kind of a reason. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. To me, it looks like the justice system is saying, yeah, we don't do as good of a job as we should do. Let's at least throw this in. You know, it just...
No, I
understand,
you.
I understand the, right. the mentality behind it, but for the reasons I gave.
It comes up diminishing someone else's murder because they for no specific reason. And exactly. It shouldn't come off that way, but it sort of does.
Yep, exactly right. That's exactly yep. right. How do you explain this tidal wave we've seen of interest in true crime?
I always tell people when they ask me that, because there is I think it's at the absolute zenith right now. People just love true crime. Millennials, everyone, they're just all love it. I think that it's like the last frontier of human behavior that obviously any normal person can't wrap their brain around how people can do. I mean, we've seen the most horrific things that you can't even believe people are capable of. And I think that's why people love horror movies, and they also watch all these crime shows, whether it's CSI or whatever, at Court TV. It's sort of to a normal person, it's inexplicable behavior, which makes it a perpetual mystery. That's my explanation for why people are so into true crime.
Now, your first book that published almost exactly a year ago from the time that we're recording this was right. Premonition.
Yes.
Well, first of all, great job on getting that first novel out.
Thank you.
Can you tell us about the story? I call this Beyond the Blurb, where I want to hear a little more than just what is on your website or what your publisher puts out. Of course, we don't want to hear the whole story, but tell us as much as you can. Go a little further than what we may see online.
I think if you look at the book jacket, it'll say that the protagonist has spent her entire life trying to avoid one thing, being murdered. So I think that one sentence sets up what I tried to do with the book. And again, I tried to use my 20 years of court TV knowledge and all of that and put it in a crime thriller. And I did incorporate 22 cases through the protagonist's point of view throughout the book, which I think makes it very unique for just a normal crime thriller. And I think I did it in a smart way. And I've gotten a lot of very good feedback on that. And I've tried to do some inside baseball stuff, show the effect covering crime like this has on TV producers, because it does. It has a huge effect on us. And I tried to show my issues with the legal system and show some kind of odd, quirky things that have happened, even in cases that are well known, but these facts never came out to the public. So I tried to really give people in a crime thriller, a fictitious crime thriller, give them a glimpse into how murders are produced on television, what goes through a killer's mind. And then I did it by making the central character just a woman who was always fearful of being murdered and her journey. So I think it's a very unique crime thriller. And I think that people who are into true crime and into all of this whole genre would definitely appreciate what I tried to do with the book.
Well, Wendy Carey-Macon, the protagonist in your story, as you just said several times, is really terrified of being murdered.
Right.
We don't always write our protagonist as we are, but is there a carryover there from you?
Yeah, I think that people say, particularly with your first book, they always say, write what you know. And I think, at least my experience writing my first novel was, as you sat down, automatically you're just pulling from all parts of your brain and your life. And there's almost no way not to do that. So I did loosely base her on me. I don't really have that fear now, but I did. There was a period in time in my life where I had this fear I was going to be murdered. And I do attribute it partly to growing up. I just remember as a child, I just remember so many seeing things in the New York Times and front page of pictures of women who were just murdered and hearing about all these horror stories. And this little girl who was the first murder I can remember hearing about is, and I was very young, was a 5-year-old girl who had been abducted in New York and then I think was strangled. And, you know, if a little kid starts to hear this stuff, you think that everyone gets murdered, even though, of course, that's not true. Mm-hmm. And I think that, so yes, it's dissipated over time, but I definitely grew up with that mentality. I think that is what led me, ironically, into wanting to do a career covering, you know, sort of fighting for victims' rights and doing it through, it ended up being done through TV journalism at Court TV.
So you had that through a large part of your life, but do you think working on true crime shows and seeing this day after day after day, did it make it worse?
It might have been so, sort of therapeutic for me. I have friends who never had that feeling, who worked at Court TV and on, you know, other crime shows, and they actually seem to be having a more difficult time dealing with, you know, murder stories or murders that occur, cases and things like that. So maybe it was a way for me to sort of work it out or something.
Well, that would make sense. It's my understanding that you included some real cases in there. How many of those did you do?
I think throughout the book, I did count it up because I was curious when I was done writing it. I did at least little tidbits of at least 20 true cases. It sounds like a lot, but it works within the book and her thoughts. So it come off like that. But and I have gotten very good feedback on that. I think people enjoyed it. And some of them, I revealed some quirky things that happened. And I did it in the sequel as well, that people never heard about, even though they were well-known cases, because everything doesn't make the news and everything, even in a trial, doesn't necessarily come out. We always hear about a lot of stuff that isn't necessarily brought to light either when a trial is covered on television.
And that's what I was alluding to earlier when I said that you have a unique perspective and advantage that other mystery writers don't have. So how did you use them? Are they referred to, or you just took pieces of the case itself and made it part of your fiction story?
No, I would like Carrie Mack and the protagonist in the book. If she, you know, I do it like she'd have trouble sleeping one night, so she would look up a case that haunted her. And so I'd mention the case, or I would refer to, I'd sort of wove it through the book. So I cases that like the Golden State Killer and BTK and different cases like that. It sort of happened naturally the way I wove it throughout the book. And a lot of it was from her thoughts and things like that. I think it was done in a very good way. And I did the same thing with the sequel, a little bit less, because the sequel is written from the killer's point of view. But I did refer to a few cases in the sequel as well.
Oh, we're definitely going to talk about the sequel then, if it's written from the killer's point of view. That sounds interesting. We're going to get to that.
I love the way it came out. It'll be released next summer.
So of those 20 stories that you put in your novel, are there any that we will recognize?
Oh, absolutely. As I just mentioned, definitely the Golden State Killer. I think Dennis Rader, BTK, the Green River Killer in Seattle and Whistler, Massachusetts. A lot of these are cases we had covered. Kitty Genovese, which was the one way back in the 60s that supposedly had like 30 plus people witnessed it and no one called the police. And I sort of explained that. The original In Cold Blood Clutter home invasion case in Kansas, the Pettit case in Connecticut. I think a lot of these, a friend of mine who recently finished reading the book said the only case in the book she had not heard about, I put Meredith Emerson in. She's a woman who was murdered in Georgia, a terrible story. So I think that case is lesser known. And then, of course, Shannon Christian, Christopher Newsom, that couple in Knoxville, and the Wichita, the Carr brothers case. And also Danny Rawlings, the Gainesville killer in Florida, who killed the college students there.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
And all of those are ones that you've covered in your work?
Yes, most of those we covered. Some we covered, like Gary Ridgway, he's the Green River killer in Seattle. We covered his sentencing. It's, you know, different parts of it, but between, and we covered Dennis Rader's sentencing, BTK in Wichita. So we, in one form or another, we covered all those.
Did you cover the Dahmer case?
That was right before I started at Court TV, and we became very good friends. Jerry Boyle, who was Dahmer's attorney, is a very good friend of mine. He's a wonderful guy. So it was covered. That was one of our first trials, so it was right before I started.
Okay, then I'm going to ask you about something specific, because it's something that affects me personally, not as I know them, but whenever I hear the story, it makes me ill. And that is the boy, I think he was 13 years old, maybe 14 years old, that got away. Mm-hmm. He had blood on him. A couple of teenage girls were trying to help him. The police showed up. Bomber said, "This is my lover. We had a spat."
Right.
The girls tried to tell the police, "No, there's something wrong here."
Right.
And the police handed the boy right back. It makes me sick because I can just, what was going in that boy's face as he was being handed back and carried away when those he should trust should have been helping him. And we know that that night is when he was dismembered and killed.
Right.
What I'm curious about is, did anything happen to those two officers?
You know, I'd have to look that up. I really don't. I don't know. I have no idea. My guess would be probably not today. I would say absolutely they probably would. I mean, that's like, just obviously, if you're a law enforcement person, you have to err on the side of protecting someone. And if he must have been desperate, you can only imagine how he must have been acting, right? So to take Dahmer's side over this kid makes no sense. And I don't want to attribute anything to anyone because it's not fair. I don't know these police officers, but you could see them rolling their eyes and saying, let them figure out their, but they do it. It's not a gay thing. They do it, you know, when they get called to domestic disputes in general. I do think, and again, I don't want to generalize at all, but I do think that cops probably approach domestic situations very differently than they approach a stranger thing. So I'm not blaming them that they didn't think it was a domestic dispute, even though they should have listened to the kid over Dahmer. But I think if they get called to a house with a straight couple and they're fighting and bickering and everything, a lot of times, look what happened with Nicole Brown. OJ, she called police on OJ a million times and nothing ever happened. It wasn't just that he was famous. I don't think, at least in the past, I don't think domestic violence was treated the same as a regular stranger murder. So the Dahmer case was back in the early 90s. That's a while ago. You might add the gay factor, you might not add the gay factor, but I think hopefully that has changed to some degree where they take it a little more seriously. And it's, so I don't know if anything happened to those cops or not, but obviously my whole take on the legal system and the justice system is you want to err on protecting people. That's why people need to be incarcerated or removed from society if they've shown they can't act normally and are endangering people. And if you have two people and one saying I'm in danger and the other saying, oh no, he's just acting crazy, you have to go with the one who thinks they're in danger. But you know, I wasn't there when it all happened. And of course, if those girls were there as well, they should have protected him.
Especially Dahmer said that the boy was his partner or his lover, or whatever term he used. And it was a 13-year-old boy and he was trying to claim he was 19. I don't know many 13-year-olds that can pass for that old.
No, I'm sure the kid looked very young. I'm sure he looked very young.
Yeah, that's
awful. That was awful. Awful.
I've heard it a trip to homophobia in the police department, but I think it was pure speculation. I don't think there was anything solid that said that was the case.
Yeah.
Though it wouldn't surprise me. Who knows?
Who knows? Yeah.
Okay, so you're a big advocate for victims' rights, and you went to law school. My understanding is that is the reason you went to law school. because of your concern over victims' rights. Is that correct?
No, when I was working for George Carlin when I decided to go to law school, and it was sort of like, it seemed like a good idea at the time, and it was sort of now or never. And I guess in the back of my mind, I always thought I would do it. I never planned to practice. And then when I graduated, it happened to be the middle of the, I'd gone back for it. I'd already been out of college. It happened to be the middle of the first OJ trial. So I thought, well, that makes sense. I never planned to go into journalism, but it just sort of fell together. And so I did get a job at Court TV, and I was there for 15 years. And I ended up leaving as VP in charge of all the live trial coverage. And I obviously loved, we all loved it there. It was just the most wonderful place to work. And we really felt like we were doing a good service.
Well, the reason I asked about the victims' right thing, here's another thing that has bothered me. Ryan Murphy signed a big contract to do multiple deals with Netflix. And one thing he did was a miniseries about Andrew Cunanan, who did kind of a murder spree and then found and he killed himself in Florida. And he killed Versace. That was why the case became known, is that he killed Versace. And Ryan Murphy, it's a great show. Typical of him, but also typical of him, he tends to bend the truth now and then. And my concern with that show, and also, I don't know if you're familiar with Darren Criss, he played Blaine on Glee, was a clean-cut character. For the first episode, all I could see was this Blaine guy, and I'm like, this was a terrible choice, but this is for anybody out there that wants to see it. By the end, he was so damn creepy, I thought, oh my God, he was a perfect choice. But going back to my concern about the show is, there is one book where a gentleman from Chicago, I think his name was Maidlin, who was a famous architect, very wealthy man, and Cunanan broke into his home while the rest of his family was on vacation, or at least went to the home. And the way it was portrayed in the miniseries is that they had had past flings, not partners, but had flings in the past. And so he was welcomed in. They did a little kinky sex play. At least that's what the architect thought it was. I don't want to say Midland again in case I have that wrong. And then in the end, Cunanan killed him. Now, the factual things we know is after the man was murdered, Cunanan just lived this carefree life in this beautiful home, cooked steak, slept in the bed. There was no sense of remorse whatsoever. But what concerns me is the family and the police say there is no connection that they have been able to find that these two ever knew each other. I think the police found one party that they happened to be at in California, but there wasn't even any proof that they had even talked to each other. So Ryan Murphy, of the many books that have been written, he grabbed the one that to me was the most juicy. What are your feelings about that? To this day, it bothers me. Because talking about victims' rights and families' rights, I can think if the family doesn't believe that was true and there's nothing to show that was true, that must have been gut-wrenching to have that shown. Okay, so first of all, somebody's gay, so they aren't necessarily the individual that they thought they were, even though they are the same. You know what I mean by that, I think.
Yes.
But also that it was this kinky sex play. And they have to picture that he was enjoying this up to the point that he was murdered. And that's where I have my concerns. Do you see that in media a lot, or fictionalized bios?
Yeah, I mean, I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of, I think the families are, you know, are always subjected to a lot of unpleasant stuff, whether it's something like that or just even the way the judge treats a lot of families in court. I've seen terrible things like that. You know, I always say the victim's no longer there to defend themselves, and the family always tries to represent them. So they're sort of at a disadvantage right out of the gate. You know?
Yeah. Well, and I think back to, I mean, there's so many cases I could pull out of my hat, but the one that comes closest is Lizzie Borden. And that's because there have been many movies that have done, probably the most famous one is the one Elizabeth Montgomery did. And I also heard it's probably one of the most least accurate, but everybody involved in that has been dead and gone for ages.
Right.
These people are still alive. I wouldn't think that legally, without the proof, that the producers or directors or whoever is making the film could get away with that.
Well, it would be up to the families to take legal action, I suppose, you know, and
yeah.
A lot of people don't want to do that for a good reason. People say there's no winning. Once you get to that point, there's no winning. It's just an ordeal.
So you think they probably just want to move on with their lives?
Potentially, or, you know, they might have sought legal advice and they told them they weren't going to really accomplish anything. You know, it's really hard to speculate on what they were thinking and what potential legal advice they might have gotten.
Well, you mentioned earlier that you worked for George Carlin, and yes. You also worked for Lily Tomlin, two people I just think are outstanding comedians and have more depth in them than just typical comedy.
Absolutely.
How did that happen? What did you do?
Well, I worked for Lilly. We had a mutual friend. I was in Boston at the time. I just graduated. And I was like her personal assistant. She was doing her original Broadway show, The Search for Intelligent Life in the Universe, which was just brilliant. I mean, Lilly is truly brilliant. And so that was a lot of fun. And then when I moved out to LA, I ended up working for George, and we became, it was a very small office, his manager, another a guy who had worked for them for a while. And we became like, you know, it was like a little family. I was incredibly close to his wife, Brenda. They really welcomed me into the family, and it was a wonderful experience. George is a great guy. He was a great guy.
Yeah, George would be great to have today with everything that's going on politically.
Very smart man.
Huge loss. Huge loss with George.
Huge loss.
Well, that's interesting that you went from working with them to law school. Is there any connection at all?
Not really. It was it was an agonizing decision at the time because I was so happy living in LA and I was so happy working for him. But it was just something I felt I had to do, and it did take me to the right place. I didn't go to law school because of victims' rights, but upon graduating from law school, once I ended up at Court TV, I'd always been in my heart, you know, for the victim. I guess, well, the murder cases I heard growing up, I always felt victim, victim, victim. So I think it did lead me to the right place. And Court TV, I would relive every minute I spent there. It was just an amazing place to work. No one who hasn't worked there can understand what an amazing place it was to work and how bonded we all were. And it was beyond a wonderful experience.
Of the many cases that you've covered, is there one in particular that was most fascinating? And by fascinating, I don't mean fun, but in the sense, Ted Bundy, I find fascinating, the whole story. And I find it fascinating from a psychological viewpoint and how he was able to carry that off. Are there any that stand out to you as the most interesting in that sense?
In that sense, I'm more obsessed always about the two cases I keep mentioning that I felt got cheated because they were such awful cases. I think that in a certain way, the Manson case, because the way they were able to get those girls to do everything, and if you know more and more about the details of it and what went on, it's hard to wrap your brain around any of these cases, but it was such a psychological thing, the way he manipulated everyone, and obviously there had to be something wrong with them to do what they did. But I think all the ins and outs of how those crimes were committed and how they were all living and all that, I think, is probably one of the more intriguing cases. But there are just so many awful cases. You know, Danny Rowling, I wouldn't say it's intriguing. It's just a tragedy what he did to those girls. And he killed one guy as well. And Tracy Palace was his last victim. And I mentioned her in the book because it was a picture I saw of her years ago where she was just looking into the camera. And then you knew it haunted me because you knew what happened to her. And she had literally the most horrific death anyone could experience. And it just, that picture of her just haunted me. And these kids just starting their lives. So there's just a lot of, I would say there are a lot of tragic cases. I guess every murder is tragic, but there are a lot of specifically really tragic cases that have haunted me. But I think if you're looking at what your question was, I would say the Manson murders for sure.
Yeah, Helter Skelter, I think it was a very well-written book.
Yeah, and I had the honor of meeting Vincent Bugliosi. He came to Court TV one day, and I spent the afternoon with him, and that was one of the highlights of my years there, for sure.
You mentioned earlier somebody must have had something wrong with them to have followed the individuals, but a lot of that is charisma as well, and that's one of the reasons why I'm fascinated with Ted Bundy, is that he was handsome and charismatic. And that's how he was able to lure women into their death. I think usually typically a white van, I think he had. I'm not sure that's accurate.
Yeah.
I think of Jonestown. You know, we know a lot of people in Jonestown were forced to drink the Kool-Aid. But right. Many just willingly walked up. I wish I could remember his name. You may know it off the top of your head.
Jim Jones.
Yes. Should have remembered it since it's called Jonestown.
Yeah.
So obviously he had something about him that he was able to... Everybody can do that. It's frightening.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a fine line between someone who's charming and a sociopath. And the way, like, there was in Ann Arbor, Michigan, years ago, there was a serial killer operating, and he would approach college girls and he would say, "What do you think? You think I'm the Ann Arbor murderer?" And then he'd take that, go off with him, and he'd go and kill them. And I think that a lot of these guys, it's surprising how I touch this in both books. I touch on this. that people always assume a killer, like Gary Ridgway is like the classic creepy killer, the Green River Killer in Seattle. He, when we did his sentencing, he just looks like this little creep, you know, it's like, but Scott Peterson was very good looking. Ted Bundy was very good looking. Carrie Stainer, who did those Yosemite killings that were so awful, or yeah, Yosemite, was very good looking. And people, it's very superficial, but people tend to think, oh, a good looking person is going to hurt me. And it's so wrong. It's so inaccurate and so irrational, but that's how people think. Part of the whole celebrity culture and the idolizing celebrities and looks and all that. Whether you're a sociopath or a psychopath has absolutely nothing to do with what you look like. You know, so something's really wrong with you. So I think those people, a lot of those guys are, yeah, they charm all their victims and lure them and people go off with them. And then they think, oops, shouldn't have done that, you know?
Well, in TVs and the movies, they make it so easy. The bad guys wear the black hats. The white guys wear the white right. hats. Monsters are always creepy.
Right.
Killers are always just strange. And
right.
So they make it look like, oh, it should be obvious.
Right, you know? Exactly. But it's not. It's definitely not.
It's definitely not. Have you seen The Thin Blue Line?
I never saw it. I know, okay. But I never actually saw it.
Yeah, it's decades old now. But yeah. The interesting thing, it kind of touches on the whole charismatic thing that we're discussing, is I believe the state was Texas. I'm almost certain. But it was two men that were involved in this murder. And as usual, one is the one that really wanted to do it, and the other allowed himself to be manipulated. And of the two men, one was, they interviewed him a lot, and he was a very striking, handsome man and well-spoken. And the other guy, average Joe, whatever. And they believe the charismatic one was the one that really was heading the whole thing. Right. And the guy who was average or maybe even a little bit unattractive was the one that got all the prison time.
Right.
Does that happen a lot?
I wouldn't be surprised. I think in our society, sadly to say, that looks do affect an awful lot of outcomes in general, whether it's a murder case or anything else. I think that people, it's just a superficial reaction people have. And that's why it's so easy for the Ted Bundys to get away with stuff, you know, or their victims. He didn't get away, but you know, that kind of thing. So I think, yes, if you had two people that committed a crime together, probably the better looking one's going to get the lighter thing potentially. And people can be very superficial, you know, even when it comes to a murder trial.
Well, studies show better looking people are the ones that get promotions too.
Yeah, I think it's across the board. I think it's just the way human behavior works. It's not fair and it's not correct, but it's the way it is.
The fascinating thing about the Thin Blue Line and really the whole gist of what the movie was about is they interviewed numerous witnesses to this event or witnessed something to this event. And what was so interesting is almost every single individual had a different story about what happened when they gave the details of what they saw.
Right.
They all contradicted each other, yet everyone was true to right. that individual.
Right.
Have you seen that?
Yeah, I touch on that in the book as well, that eyewitness testimony people think of as being the most reliable because it's sort of direct evidence. But we found, covering enough cases over the years, that people tend to see what they think they saw. And I know personally, like, I've passed someone in a car or something and thought who I saw. And then I turn around, I look and thought, that's not who I thought it was. Like, my boss used to say that when someone's proofreading, you know, we used to proofread people's writing all the time at Court TV, you tend to see, and you would miss mistakes. And you say, how did I miss? And you read it a second time. You say, how did I miss that mistake? Why didn't I catch that? You read the way you expect it to be. And then unless you do a double take and look at it again, then you see, oh, wait, they did that wrong and they misspelled that. And I think it's people always have some preset thing in their subconscious, whether they realize it or not. And yeah, if you have 10 witnesses to an event, you're probably going to get 10 different stories. People, it's very subjective. So eyewitness testimony is actually, I think, is one of the least reliable evidence in court.
It reminds me actually a lot of being a writer. No matter how good a writer is, they need an editor. And even editors that write need an editor, because I find, after I've read my book so many times, right. there may be things I've missed, but my brain fills in the blanks because exactly. I've read the book. I've read it a dozen times now. So it fills in the blanks and they're not there, or right. it's not clear, or there's mistakes that I don't see anymore. And I'll tell people, I don't see this. I don't see it anymore. So I need you to look at it. Very similar. So I'm excited to hear that your next book is going to be from the killer's perspective, because I like psychological thrillers. I like serial killer thrillers, and I like some that are lighter as well. But I find those really interesting. Doing this, and actually in your reporting on both Court TV and HLN, is it difficult? People are fascinated by what was on in the killer's head. Right. Is it difficult to report on them without sensationalizing them?
I think the way I wrote him in the book, both the first book, which he's much less in the first book, I wanted to be sort of mysterious in the background, but not really get who he was. The second book, he's really in the book. I felt that I did it in a very natural, I mean, sad to say, because I was asked about this, that I had a book party at the Mysterious Bookshop in New York, which is a really fantastic place. And I was interviewed by someone, and he asked me, was it hard to get into the mind of the killer? Because I still did it a little bit in the first book. And I said, sadly, it wasn't, because we've covered so many cases. You really do get, you get how they think and what motivates them and all of that from what witnesses have said, people who survived murder attempts and things like that. I think I did it in a very non-sensationalistic way, just a realistic way, with a touch of humor, also with a little touch of humor.
You have to have that humor in there.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just so heavy.
It
tears you down.
Yeah.
So I have a theory about something. I know some individuals that sit in front of the television and watch the news all day long. And, well, let's use Fox News for an example. People that think the whole January 6th thing has been completely blown out of proportion. So it's very easy to me to be manipulated by the news. The reason I'm bringing it up is people that I know watch the news, and we get the news coming from all directions now. Just, you know, we have 24-hour news stations. That would have been unheard of. Yeah. CNN came on board. That was like a big thing.
Right.
Not so true anymore. People I know that watch news over and over and over again tend to be more certain that they're going to be a victim. And an example is right now here in Southern California, catalytic converters are being stolen in the middle of the night. People are draining gas tanks in the middle of the night. Now that they're going down a little bit, that may not be as big of a deal. And people I know that have watched this over and over again have no doubt their catalytic converter is going to be stolen, and have no doubt their gasoline is going to be stolen. It's going to happen to them. No questions asked. I think that's because we are so bombarded with the news today. And, well, an example. In the past, if a murder took place in Tallahassee, a person in Boise probably would never have heard about it. And now we hear about it within 15 minutes on national news network. And I think it's really skewing its perception, because if I'm correct, and you may be able to correct me if I'm wrong, studies show that we are actually living in one of the safer times in history. Do you think there's something to my saying that we are allowing ourselves to be bombarded with the news and therefore have this really skewed perception about how dangerous things are?
I think you make a good point. I think years ago, people didn't hear about everything that happened everywhere. So in your own community, how often would you necessarily hear about an awful murder or an event or something like that? Today, yes, not just in the country, but internationally, people hear about everything. So it probably does appear that there's way more of it. I don't really know the stats. I know crime, obviously, in the past year or so over to the pandemic has absolutely spiked, you know, in cities and stuff in this country, but that's sort of a different issue. So I think, yeah, I think that people, if you're going to watch the news all day long, you're going to hear about more and more things, and you probably are going to become a little bit more paranoid and think you have a better chance of having something happen to you. But if you go to the stats, you know, statistically, I can't imagine the stats on what percent of the population actually ends up being murdered. I'm sure it's a very low percent, but I always say that every murder is a tragedy that should never have happened. And every murder is so awful that you want to prevent it. And still, there are thousands of murders a year, obviously, that are still committed. So you don't want that, obviously. But I think that, I think if you watch the news all day long, you're going to have a very skewed perception of what goes on in the world.
One of my favorite novels is a serial killer novel, and I searched, and I can't find the name of it because it was decades ago I wrote it, and it was before I had a Kindle, and I had to pare down my books.
Yeah.
It was a serial killer story. It took place in Canada, and it was gripping, just absolutely gripping, and the twist at the end was, it clearly was a man that was committing the murders, and the twist at the end was it was a woman. That is not common in real life, female serial killers. Have there been any?
The only one I can think of offhand is Eileen Wuornos in Florida, that that Charlize Theron played her in Monster, who's the most genius performance I've ever seen in a film, beyond amazing in that. But that Eileen Wuornos is the only female serial killer I'm personally aware of.
Why do you think that is?
Well, first of all, 80%+ of murders are committed by men right off the bat. So it's not surprising that there wouldn't be a lot of female serial killers, because it's not like it's a 50-50 split in overall murders. So 80% to 90% of murders are committed by men anyway. And then we've always found over the years that the 10 or 15% or whatever that are committed by women are generally against an abuser or, sadly to say, their own children. You had Andrea Yates, and we covered another mother in Texas who killed her two little sons and leaving babies in hot cars, things like that. So those tend to be the murders that women commit, which aren't really serial killings to begin with. So I think that the number, the percent of murders committed by women is responsible for that. And then the types of murders that women do, which a lot are considered self-defense, the ones against abusers, and then the ones against their children, you know, that's a whole other issue.
So your book was released a year ago, which I'm sure is extremely exciting. In fact, I know it's exciting. I know how excited I was when I got my first book published and actually held it in my hand. How has your life changed in that year?
I think it's reconnected me with people, you know, that I used to work with, who all were wonderful and came through, gave me blurbs and had me on their shows and all that. I'm grateful to all of them. I've met a ton of interesting people. I've done a million events and TV shows and radio interviews and podcasts like this. And I love talking about crime. It's my passion. I love talking about, I feel like I have so much knowledge that I can't wait to share with people. And I did the Morristown Festival of Books last October, and the audience was so engaged and so into crime, and they just wouldn't let me go. There was like one question after the next. So it's my passion, and I loved writing the book, and I've loved discussing it with people. So it's been just a lot of fun, and I've met a ton of interesting people. It's just been a wonderful experience. I didn't realize I would become part of this whole sort of author community. That I really didn't know what to expect, but it's been sort of an unexpected bonus to the whole thing.
We're a good bunch, aren't we?
Yep, absolutely. Wonderful.
Yeah, I find mystery writers are love to be around other mystery writers.
They are. They're great. So supportive. I can't get over how supportive everyone's been.
Yeah, you don't see competition at all. It's
not
support.
At all. I was really taken aback by it. Like, I went to Thriller Fest in June in New York, and I've met so many. There's a group of women crime writers in Connecticut. A lot of them are well known, and I've been having lunch with them and talking to them, and they couldn't be more supportive and more helpful. It's really a wonderful community.
I've seen that both in romance writers and mystery writers. And of course, you have the few exceptions that think, oh, it's, you know, they're up against everybody, but that's just a personality type. But romance writers and mystery writers both really work together. I think a large part of it is we know they're the two top genres, and there's always going to be plenty of people
at the arena. Exactly. They're readers for everybody. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you watch true crime podcasts?
I've done
or listen to, I guess.
Yeah, I've done a bunch of them. I've been so hunkered down working on this and writing that I haven't recently listened to any. I know my nieces and nephew, they're all millennials. All their friends listen to them. They love all these murder podcasts and all that. But I've actually thought of potentially doing one with a friend of mine who's also a producer, but we haven't gone that far yet. But I think I've been so involved in writing and promoting Premonition and now the second book that I just haven't taken time out to listen to the true crime stuff.
There are so many of them, and some are better than the others. Some are more well researched than the others. Some you can tell they read Wikipedia and there's their show. But I work for a podcast host, and every week we have more and more and more of these true crime podcasts out there. And you would think the market would be saturated with them. And some drop out. Either they find podcasting is not their thing, or they just don't build the audience. But there still seems like there's tons of rooms left. And I think you doing a podcast with your perspective, you would nail it.
Yeah, I think I have to get through the second book, but I am very interested in potentially doing that. I think it would be a lot of fun, and I think I could bring a lot to the table doing it.
Without a doubt. And probably help you sell your books.
Yeah, it's not a bad way to go.
That wouldn't be a bad thing to have happen. So on the sequel, when can we expect that out?
It should be out probably next June or July, and the paperback of Premonition will come out about 3 months earlier to sort of tease the sequel. My understanding is they usually release paperbacks about, if there's a second book coming, they usually release it about 3 months before. So it lets people know that the sequel is coming. And if they want to read the first book before the sequel comes out, so they can read the sequel right away. So that'll be the time frame next year, probably March or April for the paperback of Premonition, and then June or July for the second book. And I would assume pre-orders for the second book would probably be in December of the end of this year, like it was for, we're on the same cycle, I think, as for Premonition. It was put out on pre-order in late November of 2020, and then it was released in the summer of 2021. So this will be the probably November, December of 22, and then released in summer of 23, a year from now. It's the sequel. It's the continuous story. I actually started the third. I thought I could turn it into a trilogy because when I finished the second one, I had an idea of how I could start the third. So I wrote the first page of the third book if I make it into a trilogy. But I don't have to make it into a trilogy. I could leave it the way I ended it. But I certainly could make it into a trilogy. So I'll get to that, you know, at some point.
I know outside of work, I want to get this in before I let you go, because I know it's very important to you. You have other interests that you have. And one of them is dogs. You are a dog lover.
Yes.
And I'm going to tell you, I tell people I'm not a dog lover, but that is absolutely not true. I love other people's dogs. I love to play with them, but then I want to be done. And I rented the maid's quarters in this house in Brentwood, and actually not far from where OJ's home used to be. They tore it down. Not surprising. And she had a Dalmatian, and I would play with that Dalmatian all the time. And then I didn't have to feed him, and I didn't have to walk him, and I didn't have to clean up his poop. He's the best dog I ever had.
It's like being an uncle, right?
Exactly, uncle. Exactly. Right. Or a grandparent, exactly.
Right.
But you are involved with a fundraiser for No Dogs Left Behind. Is that correct?
Correct.
So what is that organization? Tell us about it.
Jeffrey Berry founded it. He's an amazing guy. And they have a Safe House in Toronto that I'm actually going up to in 2 weeks to volunteer for a week. And they bring dogs in, they save dogs. They have saved them from Afghanistan and Ukraine, but they primarily was founded to save dogs from the Yulin Festival in China and the Asian meat farms. And they have rescued thousands of dogs. So I'm just honored to be a part of it. And we're going to do a fundraiser in New York on October 1st. We'll get the details out and tickets up for sale, hopefully by mid-August. And I'll spread the word, you know, once we do. It should be a wonderful event. And there's a woman I met through there. Her name is Gail Elias, and she wrote a book. She adopted a Malamute from the meat trade slaughter truck named Ichabod, and she wrote a book on him. So she'll be there with Ichabod and one of her other rescue dogs from Asia. So it should be, and Jeffrey will be there with his three German Shepherds. It's going to be a really wonderful event, and it's a wonderful organization. And I do believe it's one of the worst sides of humanity, if you can consider that humanity, how these dogs are treated over there. It's really beyond comprehension this day and age. It's so incredibly barbaric and sadistic. It's just has to be stopped.
Now, are they considered a delicacy, or is this an everyday meal that they consider dogs? I don't mean to be gross, but.
Right. No, I think that with younger people over there, the culture is shifting, but there's still thousands of meat farms and millions of dogs killed a year. I think there has been a huge movement to stop it, and they've certainly made some progress, but they certainly haven't put a complete end to it. And like the Yulin thing is just sadistic. It's not, you know, it's just shouldn't be going on. That's all there is to it. So there are a lot of organizations working to end the meat trade, and they have definitely made some inroads in countries like South Korea and China. Taiwan, I think, was the first country to make it illegal, the first Asian country to make it illegal. So I think some progress is being made. And found this one organization, No Dogs Left Behind. It caught my eye. And they're a wonderful group of people, and I'm very happy to be doing it. And I'm very excited about going up to the Safe House and meeting some of the dogs that have been brought over.
I had a friend I worked with quite some time back, and she is one of the kindest, most gentle people you would ever meet. And something that really surprised me about her is she grew up on a farm, and the idea of a cat as a pet was really odd to her, because in her family, cats were tools. They lived in the barn. Right. They got rid of the rats. And when there were too many cats, you killed a bunch off and just continued. And that was what she grew up with. That was her perception. Is that the case in these societies? Do they not view the dogs as pets in any way, or having more intelligence than maybe other animals in any way? What is her perception?
I don't know. I haven't spent time over there. I was at the Hong Kong airport. That's my total thing. And I was in Thailand, but I haven't been to other parts of, China and stuff. I don't really know. So it's hard for me to comment on that. I think that there are a lot of people in China have pets, and a lot of pets are stolen and brought into the meat trade. They do have dogs with collars and tags, and that are owned by people that are pets. So I don't know. I don't know enough about the history of it. I just know that it's totally abhorrent and has to be stopped. And anyone who loves dogs just makes them crazy to even think about it.
Do they have a website people can go to donate?
No, dogsleftbehind.com. They've been doing a food drive for their dogs in Canada, which I just donated to in Toronto. They have a lot of dogs there. They need to be fed and taken care of. They're up for adoption.
As well.
So they have about 250 dogs to be adopted. So that's if you go to the website, you can look at the adoptable dogs and donate and all of that.
Okay, I'll put a link to the website in the show notes.
That'd be great.
You can check that out. Yep, I love dog adoption. And since we're on the topic of dogs, you may not know, but I'm just wondering, since it's similar, has dog fighting gone down in the United States in recent years? Do you know?
I have no idea. I'm sure it goes on illegally at places. I have no information on dog fighting. I really don't know anything about it. I can't imagine it doesn't happen in certain areas. It probably does.
Yeah, I lived in North Carolina, and not in my particular area that I can recall, but there were a large number of areas that dog fighting was very common, and a lot of household dogs were stolen basically to train, which is really disgusting.
Yeah, it is. People need to leave animals alone. That's my theory in a nutshell.
Well, to end this show on a positive note, read Premonition. You will not be disappointed. You'll get a whole different viewpoint than you will from other authors. I can assure you of that. And as I always say, the link to purchase that book is in the show notes. And Wendy would have no problem if you do so. So again, my guest is Wendy Whitman, and the book is Premonition. And Wendy, thank you for being on the show.
It was my pleasure. I really enjoyed it.